Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Okay, folks, welcome to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest great adventure from life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, otherwise known as Michael Parry. Bit of a voice, I'm afraid, this morning. And, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And, Leslie Ann, there's no more fitting subject that we should kick off with than that of Johnny Gold, the man, I think, who was credited with running for some 45 years, the most famous nightclub in the world, Tramp, where I assume you have been many, many times and rubbed shoulders with the great and the good and maybe even Prince Andrew.
Well, I did, you know, I did used to go there back in the 80s. A bit ashamed to say that now, because it seems like such a sort of decadent pastime. But that was one of the places to go during our sort of tenure on Fleet Street, if you like. Of course, journalists and paparazzis were banned from this place. But I think I was having a bit of a Warholian 15 minutes of fame at the time, presenting on television and that kind of stuff. Right. And I remember being taken there one night with John Taylor in Duran Duran. Do you remember? There were loads of them called Taylor in Duran Duran.
There were, but he was said to be the best looking man in the world.
Oh, he was gorgeous.
And you were on his arm, eh? That's quite.
On his arm, yes. And there we were in this beautiful oak paneled, chandeliered, kind of quite a tiny club, actually. You'd expect it to be a big, cavernous place, but it really wasn't. The dance floor was like a handkerchief.
Right.
And so everybody on the dance floor was literally connected to everybody else on the dance floor.
Yeah.
And I remember being fascinated by the ladies, the toilets, because not only did they have a little lady in there, sort of dressed in black with, you know, takes charge of the hair brushes and the makeup and the perfume.
Handing out the towels.
Handing out all this stuff. And people were putting £10 notes in her little tray instead of 50p or something, which you'd normally get in a sort of normal club. But I mean, this kind of dated back to the Beatles in Hamburg, didn't it? They were very friendly with the little lady who was the cloakroom attendant, and she used to buy their drugs for them and stuff. But this was all going on in Tramp. I'd never seen so many perfume bottles in my life. It was like Selfridges.
Golly.
So that was fascinating. But you had all manner of stars there.
Yeah.
Joan Collins used to be in there quite a lot.
In fact,
I went to see her on Monday night at the wonderfully refurbished Theatre Royal, Drury Lane. She was doing a sort of talk show to promote her new book with Graham Norton. And her sister, Jackie Collins, was married to Oscar Lerman, who was one of the co-owners.
Ah, right, of course, yeah. Where's the entrance to Tramp? Because everybody says it's so discreet, you miss it if you walk past it.
Yeah, it's like the Groucho. You've got to know where it is, really. But it's just off German Street.
Oh, yeah, German Street, where they make.
I haven't been there for years, but I did used to get a bit of a thrill going there.
Yeah.
The same as Annabelle's. You know, Annabelle's was another one of those posh places. Mm. But, I mean, we're not that kind of people, really.
Yeah.
It was founded by celebrities. I think 300 of them all lobbed in the money to start this club. And their membership, their annual fee was 10 guineas a year.
Brilliant.
What's that? Is that sort of £10, 10 shillings?
Yeah, £10, 10 shillings. So £10.50, really, I suppose. But guineas only ever used in horse racing terms, you know, because obviously it's gone. Well, I never got in there, Miss Jones, but of course I didn't hit the heights of showbiz celeb that you constantly mixed in. I did read a line which said that in those days you got dressed up to go to Annabelle's and you dressed down to go to Tramp.
Well, the men dressed down. I remember that thinking the men are all really scruffy in here, but the women were dolled up to the nines. I only just found out as well that it was named after Charlie Chaplin's character.
Yeah, you know, I read that. It's one of the obituaries. You're right.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I thought it was just because the kind of women that got in there, you know, the young sort of floozies, they were all a bit trampy looking. I thought that's what that was about.
Yeah,
I mean, it all went on in there. I remember Keith Moon got banned from there once. I think he destroyed a chandelier. And he was so upset that he was banned that he sent around a cab with £500 in cash to Johnny Gold to try and buy his way back in. And Johnny Gold just laughed and said, yeah, you're fine, come back.
Yeah.
So, oh, and that film, The Stud, that Joan Collins was in, that was partly filmed in there as
yes,
well.
Yes, it was. Yeah, that's how I remember that, yeah. Oh, well, there we go. Glam, exciting nights. Now, I'll tell you what, there's nothing glamorous about what I'm going through at the moment, trying to get my passport renewed.
I'm on the same page with you.
I am absolutely going mental. I sent my passport off in May of this year, May the 10th. I've got all the dates recorded. And I didn't even do it. I got my niece to do it because she's great. You know, she's dexterous. She can get through all the stuff on the electronic email and all that. She did it all went through. And then I was told, send in your old passport, please. I sent the old passport in. And within 3 days, I got my old passport back, hand delivered by, some company, whichever one it was.
TNT, it would have been.
Probably TNT. And the top corner was clipped off. You know the way they do that for an expired passport. So I've got an expired passport and a message saying you'll get your new one within 10 weeks. So that was May. So I thought, right, end of June, then July, should have it by the end of July. Anyway, I've then started investigating it in August and then September. We're now in October and it's just disappeared into the ether, even though they've got a record of having sent it back to me at the end of May. But it's just disappeared and it's very frustrating.
Well, there is a massive market in stolen passports at the moment.
Yeah, I suppose so.
We've had this all over the television, haven't we? People being arrested for stealing passports, and they change the picture on them. Somehow they manage to peel off that little sticky see-through bit and stick somebody else's picture. But because they're genuine passports, somebody is probably posing as you out there. I've had that before.
Yeah.
I had my passport stolen in the Plaza Hotel in New York years ago, and somebody actually used it to get into the UK.
Good God.
And it was a hell of a job to get another one. But I'm in a similar boat to you at the moment.
Yeah.
I applied recently for a fast-track passport.
Right.
So you pay £142.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is you go up there, you have an interview, you present all your personal papers. I wanted to change my name before I did various other things in my life that I needed my passport for.
Right.
But as I've been divorced for 15 years, I thought it was time that I just got rid of my married name and changed back to my maiden name. Well, this isn't an easy thing to do. They're very suspicious about this.
Yes.
So you have to go there, be interviewed, present your birth certificate, your marriage certificate, your decree absolute, and your old passport. And they guarantee for this money that you will get it back within 5 days. Well, of course I didn't. And also somebody has to sign for it. Well, they send you a photograph online of where they delivered it to. And of course, it was completely the wrong address.
Right.
They took it to the wrong place.
Right.
So then I'm having a dispute with them about this. Also, if you haven't had your documents back within 5 days, you have to let them know. But of course, they don't answer the phones.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
The Gem Passport Office don't answer the phone and TNT don't answer the phone due to high call volume.
Yeah.
So you can't get hold of them. So then I start tweeting them.
Mm.
And then every couple of days I get a tweet back from them saying, send us a direct message. Well, you can't send anybody a direct tweet
if they
don't follow you. They don't even get that. So I don't have my documents. I need the documents for other things. And it's a complete turmoil. Apparently, there are 3 million outstanding and lost passports.
It wouldn't surprise me. This country's gone into chaos. DVLC, as you quite rightly say, is paralysed by strike action. People can't get a driving licence. I was lucky. I got mine done last year and it happened very quickly and I was grateful. When I last got a passport, it was 2010. And I know that because we were going off to Germany to the World Cup and I realised I only had a few months left on it. I went into the passport office on Vauxhall Bridge Road in London. And I went in and came out an hour later with a new passport. It was as simple as that. But now...
Yeah, you can't do that in those days. Yeah.
But now I ring up the numbers that I'm given and you get through, you know, the switchboard to another number, press one, press three, press four, and all that. Eventually, you get a message saying, we cannot take your call now. We are overloaded with calls. If you leave your number, we'll phone you back in 24 hours. That's happened 10 times now, and I've not yet had a phone call back. I've got the number of the processing. You know, I've got the code number. I've got the email address of all the correspondents. And the one time I got through as a human being a couple of days ago, again, they said, it's got to go to another department. They'll ring you back. And nobody ever rings me back.
I tell you what to do. Start tweeting about it.
Well,
They will then. If you start tweeting about it, they will respond.
What, do you mean just tweet on your Twitter account and then through shame they start responding, do they?
Actually, they do. HM Passport Office, they've obviously got their own Twitter account. So follow them.
Yeah,
then
good idea.
Start tweeting. Jump up and down. You've got a huge following on Twitter.
Yes.
They're going to do something about it. So that's what I would advise.
That's a good idea. Good idea. So there you go. Anyway, look, too much moaning here, Ms. Jones.
A couple of moaning minis we are.
Yeah, a couple of moaning minis, absolutely. But let's, you're going to moan about something else now. You've probably seen the stories this
morning. What would you like me to moan about?
Well, I think you're going to moan about Wayne Rooney because there's a documentary coming out. They've apparently been paid £1 million by Amazon. That's Wayne and Colleen. And there's a clip going around of her tearfully saying, I forgive Wayne. He was only young at the time, you know, but it's really hurt me. And he's saying, you know, well, I was only a young kid. Like, you know, you don't make mistakes when you're young, don't you? You know, but I look back on it now and see the real me. But you've never been very sympathetic to Wayne Rooney, have you?
Well, no, I haven't. Not with the granny prostitutes and all the rest of it.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Nice little wife and children at home. It doesn't excuse it. If you're married, you do not go to prostitutes. End of story.
Oh, I totally
and
agree.
Especially you don't if you have a high public profile, which he does and did at the time. There's no excuse for it. It not only brings marriage into disrepute, it brings family life into disrepute and also the great game of football and his football club.
Well, yeah. Look, to make it absolutely clear, the granny prostitute thing was when he was literally 17 back in Liverpool, okay? And him and his mates all thought it was a bit of a laugh. He was 16, actually, at the time. The other prostitute...
Oh, that's all right, then.
Well, no, it's not, but he was a 16-year-old kid off a council estate in Liverpool, you know what I mean? And I'm not putting Liverpool people down. I'm saying it's a working-class environment, you know? But, no, the other allegation about a prostitute was much later on when he was a Manchester United player. He paid £200 for a packet of cigarettes. That was an allegation which he's always tried to deny. So I just want to put that on the record. You
okay,
know I mean?
It's not only that, though. There have been lots and lots of women down the years.
Well, yeah.
He's been calling loads of times.
Again, when he was called.
I don't know why she didn't leave him. That's what I would have done.
Well, this is obviously the debate that people have. Even when he was caught in the car, when he was drunk with a girl, I mean, he was trying to give her a lift home, you know. And anyway, look, you know, I've got one view of Wayne Rooney. I
feel like you feel sympathy for him.
Well, I forgive him for most things because he was the greatest footballer I've ever seen.
No. That's no excuse. That's like saying you forgive George Best for having taken a liver donated to him and transplanted into his body on the NHS and then starting drinking again. Mm. There's no excuse for that.
Oh, Miss, you're getting too judgmental now, Miss Jones. So I'm going to change the subject again. I'm going to ask you about Paul Simon.
He doesn't like a debate, not really.
Well, I do like a debate, but, you know, I'm torn between the morality of it all and my own strong feelings for Everton Football Club and all that kind of stuff. Paul Simon is 80. And when I saw your very good friend, Mike Batt, a couple of weeks ago in a TV studio, he said to me he thought Paul Simon was the greatest songwriter ever, had enormous respect for him, you know, loved all his records. Did you have any dealings with Paul Simon?
No, he was a bit before my time.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
My father been around was a long huge time. Fan. Yeah, my dad was a huge fan of Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the first albums I really remember as being something that shaped my sort of late childhood, I suppose. Bridge Over Troubled Water, one of the great compositions ever.
Yeah.
It was summer 2018 and there was a gig in Hyde Park with various artists and on comes Paul Simon. He's on his very last tour.
Right.
So he said, they always say that. I mean, I expect he's going to make a comeback at some point. But but he sang Bridge Over Troubled Water and he said to the crowd, I'm reclaiming my song. Because obviously Art Garfunkel always sang the song. Yeah. And here he was singing it himself. That was a really very special moment.
Yeah, bet it was. Mike Batt said that Art Garfunkel had an angelic voice and that's why he always sung the songs that Paul Simon wrote.
And also because he sang Mike Batt's own song, Bright Eyes.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, of course he did, yeah. I remember when I was about 18 or something, Paul Simon had a song out called 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, okay?
Great song.
What is it?
Get out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. No need to be coy, Roy. Just listen to me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we were in a pub. This is in Chester, right? And me and my girlfriend had a bit of a row about something again. I think she claimed that I'd turned up drunk or something like that, or hadn't turned up or something like that. And I said, oh, I'll give it a rest. So I go over the jukebox. We had jukeboxes in pubs in those days, right?
I loved the jukebox, didn't you?
Yeah, I love jukeboxes. Put in your 5 shillings or something, you get 20 tracks or something like that. And anyway, I love this song, so I just put it on. Anyway, it comes on, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. She bursts into tears, throws a huge fit, knocks the glasses off the table and rushes off. She thought it was a message. She thought it was...
come on, Mike, it probably was.
No, it wasn't. I never even thought about it. I didn't even
know. You must be sick. I mean, God, the very title of the song, not just the lyrics, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, come on.
Yeah, well, no, but I didn't, honest to God. Perhaps I was being a bit insensitive or something. But anyway, there we go. Say again.
You think.
I think.
Yeah, that's what they say in America, darling. You spend enough time there.
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, okay. All right, I'll believe you on that one. Now then, what was I going to say? Yes, are we going to have a winter of discontent? Because I'm unfortunately old enough to remember the last one. Now, you won't be old enough to remember it disrupting your life very badly. But in 78, which was the winter of discontent, which led to Jim Callaghan losing...
Of course I remember that.
Yeah.
78.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I don't think it affected your life as much as it affected mine. Jim Callaghan came back from a tour abroad. Crisis, what crisis, he said to a reporter as he got off the plane. And the following year, Mrs. Thatcher swept to power and the rest is history. But what I was going to say was, it really was a winter discontent. I was working as a reporter on the Birmingham Mail. I lived and worked in the Redditch District Office, lovely little town in Worcestershire. Lots of good stories there because lots of pop stars lived around there, as you probably know, in the Midlands, And and anyway, I remember one night I went out with my mate, who was the other reporter in the office, and he lived about 2 miles away. There was no petrol around, so we didn't have any petrol in our cars. And the snow was down. It really was a winter discontent, 3 or 4 inches of snow on the ground. So I had to walk over to his place. He came out. We then had to walk to the pub, which is another 3 miles away, because you couldn't use your cars because there was no petrol, right? We got into the pub, and the pub was lit by candlelight. There was no electricity. The electricity had been cut off, okay? And there were a few people in the pub. The landlord was going down into the cellar and bringing the beer up in pails and buckets because there was no electricity to make the pumps function to pump the beer up from the barrels. I mean, it really was the winter of discontent, honestly. And I would hate it if the country grinds to a halt like that again this winter.
We're unlikely to get the snow of those days because of climate change and global warming and so on. Mm. It's never going to be that bad again.
You hope.
But we need to be worrying about that. I saw something on television this week, which was comparing, this was to do with the gas crisis.
Yes.
And gas prices rocketing and gas companies closing down and so on.
Yes.
And our reliance on gas as a fuel in this country, compared to countries like Germany, who have such a high coal consumption.
Of course.
And I didn't realise this.
Oh, yeah.
That actually countries like Germany are literally poisoning the planet.
Yeah.
And all of these summits about climate change are not going to have any effect at all unless countries like Germany and China and so on are all going to get on board with us and say, right, we have to stop burning coal because this is what is causing climate change.
Yeah, well, if that's the theory and everybody believes it, but Germany won't. You probably remember Kyoko. That was the famous, you know, conference at which all the leading nations of the world signed this fantastic deal, Kyoko, you know, climate change and all that. Not one single issue in the document, which contained 360 specific moves, not one of them has ever been implemented. And that was 2009. I reckon exactly the same will happen at the old COP26, or whatever it's called, that's happening in Glasgow in a couple of weeks' time, honestly.
Well, it will. And so why are they wasting all this money on this summit?
No idea. Why wasting the fuel flying people in and all that? And you're absolutely right about China and Germany. India also is a huge coal-burning country. China's building about one new coal-fired platform, power station a month. They couldn't care less about the environment, honestly. And they're also in the market now to buy up all the gas that there is in the world because there's a natural gas shortage. Oh, I don't know. It's all...
So China is killing the planet. So we need to somehow find a way of boycotting China. I know we all use mobile phones and all the parts are made in China. Mm. We need to stop that somehow. Oh, yeah. This is almost on a sort of James Bond scale.
It is, yes, I agree.
The rest of the world. And everybody is just sitting there doing nothing about it.
Yeah, guess where all our wind turbines are made? China. Everything in the world is made in China. And so you say, oh, well, we've got to... I was supposed to have some blood tests, okay, just routine ones that go with my heart condition. And I was supposed to have them 6 weeks ago. I still haven't had the call because they haven't got any files to put the blood in, you know, the little glass tubes. They haven't got any.
Oh, the vials, yeah.
Yeah, and guess why? They're made in China.
And
China can't produce enough at the moment because of the, you know, the demand from around the world for COVID. It's unbelievable.
Because of COVID. Yeah. So why is the world not waking up to this and going, hang on a minute, all the stuff that's manufactured in China can be made in other countries, and we should be making moves to boycott China on a massive scale.
I totally agree, but it will be like turning an oil tanker around. If you suddenly say, right, we're going to bring... You see, the great irony of it is we say, oh, in this country, we're doing a brilliant job. We've cut down our emissions by 30% since 2012. But that's only because we exported the manufacturing to China. And that's where they're burning the coal to make the goods that they send back to this country. Look, it's all mad, but what do I know about it? Nothing. Let me cheer you up with a better story than that, Miss Jones, and that is of Angela Rippon, who is 77, funnily enough, this week.
She really? Gosh, yeah. She's wearing well, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she's wearing very well indeed. And when I worked in America in New York, Angela Rippon suddenly lost her job at the BBC. That guy who was the BBC programme chief, who you and Roger Taverner used to follow around a lot. I think he lived in North London somewhere. What was his name?
Not John Burt.
Yes, John Burt. That's right. John Burt. Yeah.
We used to terrorise him. Yeah, we did.
He did. I remember Roger used to come in every morning and I said, well, to get up to last night. Oh, we went up to John Burt's house, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
That used to be fun doing stuff like that. I mean, imagine that now. Yeah. Let's go and doorstep John Burt just for a laugh.
Yes, that's right. The head of the BBC.
We wouldn't do it, would we?
Yeah. But anyway, according to legend, John Burt said to Angela Rippon when she was about 45, I'm sorry, Angela, but your time's over. You just got to make way for younger people. Which, of course, if you said these days, you'd get badly sued. You know what I mean? I mean, you really would for ageism. But anyway, she ended up leaving and she went to Boston. So for some bizarre reason, she went to a TV station in Boston. Well, I was working in New York, and as soon as she arrived there, I got up there first, ahead of everybody else, to, you know, find out what it was all about, what she was doing. And they disliked her, the Bostonians. Who's that limey bird on the television? Get her off, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But everybody was chasing around trying to find her. And, of course, you know, it's one of those things. We spend all day traipsing around Boston, traipsing around the TV studios, traipsing around, you know, where you think her agent works. And you come back to the hotel at 9 o'clock, quick drink in the bar, and then into the lift. And guess who steps into the lift? Angela Rippon. It was one of those, you know, couldn't make it up type encounters.
How hilarious. How did you handle that one?
Well, with the plume that I normally try to handle things, you know, I said, oh, Miss Rippon. And she was very, very withdrawn. And I explained who I was. I always think you've got to be honest. And so, look, I'm a reporter from the Daily Express. But, of course, I tried to use the sympathy card. Oh, Miss Rippon, please, I've come all the way from London, you know, to see you here, to watch your debut. You know, I can't possibly, you know, ring my office and tell them that, you know, I haven't got something to give them and all that kind of stuff. You know, I have no wish to speak to you. Please leave me alone. As we got out of the lift on her floor, if you do not leave me alone, I will call hotel security. And I thought, that's the last thing I want, isn't it? You know, a story about me harassing Angela Rippon, you know what I mean? So
you're fed up, not hard up.
Yes, exactly, that's right. So I had to withdraw, but then, of course, using rat-like cunning,
that old phrase.
Yes, that's right, yeah. I got back down to reception, sweet-talked the receptionist, found out what room she was in, found out what time she'd booked breakfast and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? Found out what time her car was coming, and needless to say, I was outside the hotel at 5:30 in the morning, you know, as her car arrived and she came out. And, of course, I did the usual reporter's trick. I probably exchanged 2 sentences with her, I would think, okay? But I got a double-page spread in the Daily Express out of that. My exclusive interview with Angela Rippon. Something, of course, you were brilliant at doing yourself, Miss Jones.
Well, thank you, but you only ever needed 3 questions and 3 answers and you had a double-page spread. It's classic Rod Gilchrist technique, isn't it, really?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But
well done you. Yeah, so presumably she wasn't very pleased with what you wrote.
Well, I don't know. I didn't stick around to find out. You know what I mean? I filed my stuff and then left Boston, went back to a real city called New York. Didn't like Boston very much. I stayed at a place called the Copley Plaza Hotel, and it's very sort of, oh, I don't know, almost like, you know, back to the mid-20s or something like that. But
do you remember when Martin Dunn...
I was about to say.
He went to edit the Boston Globe, didn't he?
No, Boston Herald. That was Rupert's
Boston
paper.
Herald.
There were 2 papers in Boston, the Boston Globe, which is a more famous one, and the Boston Herald, which Rupert Murdoch bought, which was edited by Martin Dunn. You quite rightly say, your friend of mine, who went on to much greater things. He became the editor of the New York Daily News. But then it was either before, I think it was before Martin, Les Hinton was the editor of the Boston Herald.
Was he indeed? I didn't know that.
And Les Hinton went on to become chairman of News International, Rupert Murdoch's international company. And then ended
his career in disgrace.
Well, you say that it's alleged disgrace. The thing with Les is Les left during the phone hacking scandal. And many would say, and he hints at this in his book himself, which I've read, book about his lifetime, he does hint that he might have been the kind of sacrificial lamb.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, have you got a filing cabinet?
Yeah, I've got 3.
Now, John Lewis have now said that that's it. They're not stocking or selling any more filing cabinets. People don't use them anymore. Everything is stored on computers. Have you ever been through your filing cabinets to find out what kind of junk you've accumulated over the last 30 years?
Yeah, I did try that once, but there's never time to sort it out,
no,
is there?
No.
I've got a vast collection of newspaper cuttings, magazine stories, photos, documents, school reports of my children, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And yes, I do. I probably need to spend about a month going through all the files and throwing away most of it, I should think. Bills from 2 houses ago and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I never get time to go through it, so I just buy another filing cabinet.
Yes.
But I suppose now that they're going to stop selling them, frankly, I don't want everything to be on a computer.
Because no, do
what I. Happens, what happens when the power blackout comes and we can't access any of our documents?
Totally agree.
Everything that's stored on computer, all of that will be lost.
Yeah,
because people don't even have photo albums anymore, for example. They store all their photos on their laptops and on their computers, and eventually that is going to bite them in the bum because everything will be lost in some blackout.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with all of that. And, you know, I so fear email technology. Even now I've got to work out how to sign a consent form because the saga of my tooth goes on. Have I told you about my crown that doesn't work?
No. Oh, well, right. How can a crown not work?
Well, a good question. So about 3 months ago, I first started feeling a twinge in the back of my my mouth, and it's on the lower sort of gum. And I'd look in the mirror to see there was one of those old-fashioned sort of black fillings, right? And I knew immediately, self-diagnosis, that's probably cracked because it was starting to hurt when I put, you know, pressure on it. So I go and see the doc. Great doctor, has been treating me for probably 30, 35 years. He's replaced every tooth in my mouth with either a crown or an implant.
So this is a dentist, not a doc.
Well, no, he's a dental surgeon. He's also a doctor. So I call him Doc because he is Dr. Cullen.
I see. Okay.
So anyway, he looks at it and it's another crown. So he takes out the old filling, the last black one I had. I used to have a mouthful of black fillings, but they all came out and been replaced. And to start off with, as I'm sure you know, everybody knows, you have to have the first bit of the crown done. Then they put a dressing on it. And then 6 weeks later, when your mold's been sent away and it comes back and you've got your crown, it's fitted onto the stump, so to speak. So all goes well. After about 3 days, I could still feel it. And I thought, that's probably my bruised gum or something. Then after a week, I could still feel it. And then after 2 weeks, it got worse. So I go back to see the doc. And he says, yeah, he said it could just be torn ligaments. I didn't know you had ligaments in your teeth, but you do apparently. So, really? Yeah, so he gave me a shot of something and then gave me some painkillers and said, that should be okay. 2 weeks later, it's now got worse. It's now sensitive to heat and cold, okay? Now, the whole process for the crown cost £1,000.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Oh, no, this is terrible. He's going to have to do it again.
Well, no, you see, that was my thought. But then I went back to see him and he said, look, the problem is not the crown. He said, the problem is it's the nerves now below what was left of your tooth. They've got to come out. You've got to have a root canal.
Oh, no, horrible.
So he said, and to be honest, I could do it, but I want to send you to a hospital in Harley Street, which has got much more sophisticated equipment. So that's now booked in. That's going to cost another £1,200, right?
Oh, no. Have you got health insurance?
No. And that's now taking place in 3 weeks' time. But they send you this form, which you've got to sign off as whatever it's called, you know, a permission to work on it and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Do you want me to come and hold your hand?
No, it's all right. I'll do it somehow. But I'm told it can be very painful. But it won't be for me because I pay dentists to pump my mouth so full of Novocaine that it makes my whole face freeze, never mind my jaw and my gum, because I can't stand pain. But it looks horrendous. They actually drill down through the teeth and pull the nerve out.
No. You ought not to be driving yourself there and back.
Well, no, I won't be.
That much stuck in you.
No, I won't. It's in Harley Street. So, you know,
how just get home. Do you want me to come pick you up?
No. Get the train home. Don't worry about that. You know,
you can't get the train home after having dental surgery.
Yes, you can. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. I'll be absolutely fine. And look, if I feel at all woozy at all, I'll just order a car to take me home. Won't be a problem, honestly. But
don't get on the train, Mike. You'll end up on the tracks.
On the tracks? You think I am? Goodness gracious me! But anyway, that's the saga. Now, listen, we can't have a Planet Porky podcast without talking about our favourite subject, which of course is the Beatles. Another spread in a newspaper this week about the new book that's coming out shortly, Get Back. And another great anecdote about a conversation between Paul McCartney and John Lennon as to whether Billy Preston should join the Beatles full time and the Beatles become a group of five. And John Lennon muttered that sounds great, you know, this is the way forward. And Paul McCartney totally against it.
Well, you can't suddenly add people to a lineup, can you?
Exactly.
I mean, they had this issue with the Rolling Stones back in the day. Mm. They had a pianist who was there right from the beginning called Ian Stewart. He was known as to everybody. And he didn't really look the part, didn't look like a rock star. He's a bit sort of lantern-jawed and a bit heavy. He was Scottish and so on.
Yeah.
And when Andrew Lew Golden, the bright upstart manager, came along, mm-hmm. first thing he did was kick Stu out of the band. Yeah. But, oh, but you can still be the roadie and you can still play piano on tour, which kind of is the point. More than five people in a band is a bit much for fans to get their heads around. Mm-hmm. But you can have as many people as you like on the road playing live with you.
Sure.
So, you know, absolutely they should not have added to the Beatles lineup because you can't. Yeah. That Ringo, George, John, Paul thing, that was a very special chemistry.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You can't add to that, but you can bring other musicians on tour with you. Mm. Unfortunately, they didn't tour after 1966, so they never had that opportunity.
No, absolutely. I mean, it was just ridiculous. I think it was just John Lennon trying to wind up Paul again, wasn't it? You know,
and probably, yes.
And part of all the tension. Talking about that, and we don't wish to go on and on about the Beatles, but this is an amazing story. Well, yeah, I do. I totally agree. How about this? A Beatles fan has spent years collecting steamy photographs of the Fab Four, dash, drinking cups of tea. This bloke collects pictures of the Beatles, but only if they've got a cup of tea in their hand, right? His name is, he's a librarian. His name is Hugh Spink. And he was once asked to find a picture of George Harrison having a cup of tea for, you know, some particular research book or something like that. He then became fascinated, excuse me, my voice is a bit rough this morning, by pictures of the Beatles drinking tea. And he's now got over 400 pictures of the Beatles drinking tea. Before I read this in a national newspaper, I don't think I've ever seen any Beatle holding a cup of tea.
No, I must be honest, I haven't. I've got a number of pictures of the Beatles smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
Seeing rock stars smoking nowadays, it's quite unusual. You don't see pictures
like
that.
No,
you don't. No. So I've got some of those. But I mean, I can understand the unusual collection and the urge to do that. Mm. I, for example, collected sick bags off of aeroplanes for years and years and had a vast collection.
You're taking the mickey.
What?
You're taking the mickey.
I'm absolutely not taking the mickey. The other thing I collected was shower caps.
Oh, yeah,
so all the hotels I stayed in around the world, I always kept the shower caps. I used to always take two and I'd keep one for myself. I'd send the other one to my Auntie Anne down in Gravesend.
Really?
And she's got a vast collection of shower caps as well. And she keeps them all in a massive drawer. And when people come around to visit, she shows them.
Yeah.
These are all the shower caps from all the hotels that LA has been to all over the world. Mm. So I think unusual collections. I never met anybody else who collected shower caps. Until I went to a dinner party at Simon Kinnersley's house a few years ago.
Right.
Do you remember Simon Kinnersley?
He rings a bell. Was he editor?
He also was a journalist. He worked on the Daily Mail.
Was he editor of The Independent?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, go on.
No, he was a writer, journalist. Hmm. And he also had a vast collection of shower caps. So you must have collected something unusual over the years.
Well, funnily enough, I did, because like you, I thought, you know what? One of these days, my life is going to be determined by all the hotels I've stayed in around the world. So right early on, one of the first jobs I ever did was in Northern Ireland, Belfast Europa. I've still got a bar of soap from there. And I then started collecting bars of soap from the bathrooms or the hotels, right? And I have literally got them from all over the world. But the other thing I used to collect, particularly I worked in America, were boxes of matches.
Oh, the same. Say, I did that too.
Right. Now, you know, every time you walked into a hotel and you were waiting for the receptionist, there was always in America, there was a bowl there with boxes of matches in it, weren't there? You know, the flick open boxes of matches. And they were very colourful. You know, they really were like an advertising board for the hotel, because everybody walked around with packets of matches in those days and would offer you a light striking a match on this packet, which had a picture of the hotel on it. You know what I mean? And I've somewhere, I've got about 300 or 400 packets of matches and about 300 or 400 bars of soap. So it's...
Well, you need to get rid of the matches, because I similarly had a huge vase, vase that was, I'm not joking, about 3 feet high.
Right.
Glass, kind of square vase, with all the book matches, I think they used to call them, and little boxes of matches all stacked in that I collected from all over the world.
Wow.
And I read a piece, I think it was in a Sunday Times magazine, about how these things can spontaneously combust.
Oh, really? Because
all that sulfur on the end of the match.
Yeah, I can believe that.
So I thought, I don't need this fire in my house. Yeah. So I threw them all away.
Do you know what? That's a very good bit of advice, except I haven't got a clue where they are.
I don't know where they are. You'll know when they explode.
I will. They're in the loft somewhere. I've got a loft full of suitcases, which I've, you know, put stuff in over the years and bound up and then wrapped in plastic black bags and all that kind. I'll have to go looking for them. On the shower caps, by the way, I used to also take the shower caps, but not because I used to collect them. I was having quite a long romance with a married woman.
Oh, here we go again.
Yeah. Well, it was just unfortunate. And she had luxuriant long hair. And whenever we had a sort of afternoon delight session, you know, at a hotel or something like that, she would always obviously have a shower before she went home, in case, you know, the aroma of my aftershave.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Too much information.
Well,
that's
too much
disgusting.
Information.
No, come on.
No, but
family show, Mike.
No, yeah, okay, but I'm just saying the practicality. So I always used to collect these. What are we talking about? Hair containers? What are they called? And I used to take them with me when, you know, we went out in the afternoons, because it meant then she could have a very quick shower without her hair having to get wet, because she would then have to explain to somebody at home why she had wet hair after working in a Fleet Street office all afternoon. But anyway, there we are.
Get caught in a shower, darling.
Say again?
Get caught in a shower, darling.
Yeah, in the middle of July with the sun shining. It didn't always...
Oh dear, this is scraping the barrel.
Well, I wouldn't say scraping the barrel. I would say that it was very practical.
Do you remember the other thing? When we used to go, business class, first class on all those flights, collecting the little amenity kits.
Oh, yeah, I've got loads of those. You're absolutely right.
I had loads of those as well. I got rid of them all in the end.
Push bags.
They disintegrate. The materials that they make them with start to perish.
Well,
funny sort of plastics and rubbers and stuff like that.
Some of them are leather. Some of them are leather. I've got
one. Some of them are, and I've still got a couple, but all the other ones, I threw them away.
Yeah, well, I think I've got a leather one from Emirates Airline. And I think I've got a leather one from British Airways and from Qantas, all of which I flew first class in, which was great.
Well, we sound like a pompous couple of twats, don't we, here?
Yeah, we do, actually, yeah, but we're very lucky people. Talking about Qantas, Australia's opening up again. Sydney nightlife's opening up again. I do hope Sydney returns to what it used to be, like the fun party city of the world. Did you spend much time there?
I've never been to Australia.
Oh, okay.
I just have a phobia about flying that distance without stopping. 12 hours is my limit, so Los Angeles is as far as I have ever gone.
Yeah.
I've been a bit worried about the whole Sydney situation, because my nephew, Alex, is down there.
Right.
And he's kind of trapped down there. He went down on one of those young people's work programs.
Sure.
Where they have to do farm work and various other things, and they contribute and they work towards getting their permit to stay in the country so that they can work legally. But because COVID came along and the lockdowns and everything else, he's literally been trapped there. He paid $10,000 to the government for his right to do all these various stages.
Sure.
It's all gone a bit horribly wrong. So he's been quite fed up down there. But I've managed to introduce him to a couple of friends who have... friends in high places, shall we say. So let's hope they sort it out soon.
Indeed. Well, talking about Sydney anyway, I went there once, and the reason I went was I was going out with a young lady who was...
Oh, God.
Yeah.
You're incorrigible. You really are.
She worked for the PR company that represented Qantas, okay? And she lived in Windsor and worked in the West End, and I met her at some, you know, press function or something like that. So she said, why don't we go to Sydney for the weekend, you know? I thought, that's rather nice. And we got on board this huge Qantas aircraft at Heathrow and headed straight for first class because there were a couple of spare seats. So it was a wonderful experience, you know, no problem. Anyway, we get down to Sydney. When I say the weekend, we were going for about 5 days, you know, from about sort of Friday to Tuesday or something like that. The morning after we got there, so we spent one day there, she had to go back. She got recalled to London for some crisis or something like that. You know what I mean? So you've got to go back. So she goes back. She says, oh, I'm awfully sorry, darling. So she was leaving me in Sydney for 3 days on my own, you know. And I thought, wow, what an opportunity. So I immediately got in touch with an old mate who you may or may not know of called Frank Thorne. Do you remember Frank?
I don't.
No, of course you won't, because he wasn't in your world. He was in my world. He was an investigative reporter with the People, and then I think he went off to the News of the World. But anyway, he was one of these great old-fashioned sort of, you know, dirty raincoat type investigative reporters and all that kind of stuff. But Frank did like a drop of the old booze now and then, and he met a barmaid in a late night drinking club in Fleet Street, the one up behind the old Mirror building, and I forgot what it's called now.
But, the Stab.
The Stab was the pub, but this was a late night drinking club in the same road.
Oh, okay, I don't know.
Yeah, but I can't remember what it was called. Anyway, there's an Australian girl working in there. Frank staggers in one night, the worse for drink, falls in love with this girl, leaves his wife, and moves in with this Australian girl, and then Frank sort of drank himself out of work, you know what I mean? It happened to a lot of our colleagues in the sort of 70s and 80s in Fleet Street. But, you know, if he, you know, sold the half of his house, which was his and all that, he'd have enough to go and start a new life in Australia. And so Frank did. So I went off down there. So anyway, I suddenly thought, I wonder if Frank's around. And I found a number for him, ring him up. And it was so joyous to reunite in Sydney. And we went to a pub called the Lord Nelson for lunch because it served traditional English fish and chips. So it was a walk up from the Hyatt on the Rocks, the pub that I was staying at, the one that overlooks the Sydney Opera House. And I met Frank up there, and it was a really joyous, you know, you can imagine it, two Fleet Street hacks, you know, known each other for 20 years, suddenly on the lash together in Sydney. But Frank's tolerance to drink had sort of fallen a bit. So anyway, we had a few drinks there, and Frank was starting to wobble a bit. And I said, oh, well, he said, I'll come back. He said, I love the Hyatt on the Rocks. They've got a great cocktail bar there. Let's go back there and have it. I said, okay, yeah, fine. So we got back there. And then Frank started to be decidedly unwell. I said, look, Frank, you better come to my room. You know, I think you're going to need the bathroom. And we got up there. Frank walked out onto the balcony to look at the view, overlooking the Sydney Opera House, and then collapsed onto his hands and knees and vomited two bottles of red wine all over the balcony, right?
No, what, yes. Over the side?
No, on the floor of the balcony.
Oh, actually, yeah. On your balcony? Oh,
yeah,
no.
Actually on the balcony. Oh, no. And he was on his hands and knees. So I thought, I suppose I better ring somebody. So I rang down to reception. I said, oh, hello. And I explained, look, I'm terribly sorry. My friend's with me. He came up to have a parting drink with me. I'm afraid he's been unwell. And it's a bit of a mess, and we're going to need like a bucket and a mop, and no worries, problem. Honestly, the girl on the desk downstairs said, not a problem at all, sir. Don't worry about it. 2 minutes later, knock, knock, knock on the door. A door opens. There's four people there, two of them with buckets and mops. They walk in. They say, right, where's the problem? I said, out on the balcony. And Frank was still on his hands and knees because I couldn't get him to move. Anyway, the four of them picked him up. Right, so he's a piece of furniture, one in each corner, carried him through the bedroom and put him in the bath, right? honestly. And Frank was still on his hands and knees. And then they brought buckets out and they swished it all absolutely clean. You wouldn't know anything had happened. And they were smiling all the time, you know, saying, no.
Oh, imagine doing that job. How horrible.
Yeah. Absolutely no problem, sir. Yeah. No. These things happen, sir. You know, we want people to be feel welcome here, whatever the circumstances. So then they did all that. So then they went back, took their buckets away, came back, and picked Frank up out of the bath again like a piece of furniture, and then carried him out down the corridor, down into the lobby, where they'd arranged for a car to be waiting to put Frank in the back. It was a pickup truck, right? And they put Frank in the back of the pickup truck. They managed to get his address out of him and took him off home. And it was all very Australian, you know what I mean?
And you never saw him again?
I did. 2 days later, he rang to apologise, and I was leaving that night, and said I was so sorry. I said, not a problem at all. He said, look, I'm going to come down, just take you for a last drink. I said, do you think I'd
apologise? Oh, dear. Yeah. No, here we go again.
Yeah, he said, yeah. And do you know where he took me? He took me to the hotel where Michael Hutchence hanged himself.
Oh, God, that hotel's been knocked down now.
It has been knocked down now, but it wasn't then. And to my utter amazement, Frank knew the guy there because he'd done the story so many times, walked in, saw the manager, and he said to the manager, is it all right if Mike has a look at the room?
No, you didn't.
I swear to you, we went up to the room. He showed me the hook on the back of the door.
Oh, no, that's macabre. Why would you do that?
Well, it was just out of sheer, you know, I don't know, fascination, I suppose.
Why would you do that? That's a very, very strange thing to do.
No, it was all at Frank's insistence. You know, come on, you've got to come and see the room. Now, I thought, do I really want to see this?
Where is the hook from which he dangled? I think there's something a bit sick about that.
Well, I do as well. But the most amazing thing about it was the room was still available for hire to any hotel guest.
And yeah, so you get these nutcase fans, and there are millions of them around,
yeah,
who want to go and stay in that room,
yeah,
because Michael Hutchence hanged himself in there.
It was unbelievable. There's
something so weird about that.
Yeah, and I said, sorry. I said, is that what you sold the room on? He said, no, we don't tell people it was the Michael Hutchence room. He said, to us, it's just another room. He said, but sometimes people find out the morning after that they've been staying in the room where Michael Hutchence hanged himself. And I thought, I tell you what, you should have told me. How upset would you be if you found that out at breakfast the next day?
Well, I mean, practically, being straight about it, yeah, Nothing's going to happen to you. It's not like he haunts that room or anything.
No.
It's just a very weird thought.
Yeah.
But I had a woman, a Queen fan, recently wrote to me,
yeah,
and sent me some photographs. And she was lying in bed wearing one of those kind of toweling white, you know, yeah, dressing gowns that you robe, have in hotel rooms, robe thing. She was lying in bed, and she put all these pictures, including the picture of the door with the number on it outside. And this was the room at the Montreux Palace Hotel in Switzerland where Freddie Mercury used to sleep.
Right.
And she rented that room every year to stay in because, yeah, he used to sleep in that bed.
Well,
look, it's probably not even the same bed.
No, it wouldn't be the same bed, but it's the same room. I can kind of understand that. That's a bit of hero worship. At least it wasn't maudlin and, oh, you know, at least Freddie Mercury didn't die there or anything like that, you know. But you're absolutely right. You know, adulation, particularly amongst fans of pop stars, can really go to extreme lengths, can it not? Righto.
Some very, very weird, yeah, communications from, yeah, some of these excessively extreme fans, yeah, let's call them.
No.
And I just think sometimes, get a life.
Yeah, that's right. No, I totally agree with you. Right. Okay, Miss Jones, well, thank you very much for your company for the last 45 minutes or so. Thank you to all you millions of listeners for tuning in again. And Leslie Ann, I hope you're going to have a great week ahead. And it's fair to say we'll be back with the listening audience very soon. We were in a pub, this is in Chester, right? And me and my girlfriend had a bit of a row about something again. I think she claimed that I'd turned up drunk or something like that, you know. You know, or hadn't turned up or something like that. And I said, oh, give it a rest. So I go over the jukebox. Jukeboxes in pubs in those days, right?
I loved the jukebox, didn't you?
Yeah, I love jukeboxes. You know, put in your, you know, what your 5 shillings or something, you get 20 tracks or something like that. And anyway, I love this song, so I just put it on. Anyway, it comes on, you know, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. She bursts into tears, throws a huge fit, you know, knocks the glasses off the table and rushes off. She thought it was a message. She thought it was...
Well, come on, Mike, it probably was.
No, it wasn't. I never even thought about it. You know, it's just, I didn't even know.
You must be sick. I mean, God, the very title of the song, not just the lyrics, yeah, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, come,
yeah,
on.
Yeah, well, no, but I didn't, honest to God. You know, perhaps I was being a bit insensitive or something. But anyway, there we go. A door opens. There's 4 people there, 2 of them with buckets and mops. They walk in. They say, right, where's the problem? I said, out on the balcony. And Frank was still on his hands and knees because I couldn't get him to move. Anyway, the 4 of them picked him up, right, as though he was a piece of furniture, one at each corner, carried him through the bedroom and put him in the bath, right? And yeah, honestly, and Frank was still on his hands and knees. So I always used to collect these, what are we talking about, hair containers, what are they called?
Shower caps.
Hair containers. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear Figs. because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your figs? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room listening to this podcast, wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.